From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
One, two, three, hit it! Watch me! Watch me! I got it! Watch me! I got it! Hey!
The godfather of soul, the hardest working man in show business, soul brother number one. They all mean the same thing, James Brown. On today's Fresh Air, James Brown talks with us about his life and music. He has a new memoir called I Feel Good. Also, Maureen Carrigan reviews a new book by Adam Hochschild about the abolitionist movement in England. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
Now I got a move that tells me what to do. Sometimes it's tears. Now I got a move that tells me what to do.
First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've always wanted to have James Brown on our show. The publication of his new autobiography has given us that opportunity. The book is called I Feel Good. Along with James Brown, we'll also meet his wife, Tommy Ray. She's a singer in his band. Although I always introduce our guests, I think there's someone who can introduce James Brown a lot better than I can.
So now, ladies and gentlemen, it is start time. Are you ready for start time? Thank you, and thank you very kindly. It is indeed a great pleasure to present to you at this particular time, national and international known as the hardest working man in show business, man that's saying, I'll go crazy. Try me. You've got the power. Think. If you want me, I don't mind. Bewildered, million-dollar seller, lost someone. The very latest release, Night Train. Let's everybody shout and shimmy. Mr. Dynamite, the amazing Mr. Please Please himself, the star of the show, James Brown and the Famous Flame.
James Brown, Tommy Ray Brown, welcome to Fresh Air. James Brown, I want to start with your first record, recorded in 1956, Please, Please, Please.
Right.
Now, I understand this record almost didn't get released. Your new book says that the owner of King Records, Sid Nathan, didn't want you to release this. What didn't he like about Please, Please, Please?
Well, it was repetition to him because I continued to say Please, Please, Please. And he heard me say, please, please, 26 times. And didn't ever, you know, had that kind of concept or that kind of music. It was like gospel ballad, you know. And he couldn't understand the pulsating, bam, 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 please, please, please. He couldn't understand that. But that was a new horizon coming by him. He totally different from what he'd heard before.
Well, I guess they made a mistake. So
I'm glad they did.
Yeah. So let's hear your first single, Please, Please, Please.
Please, 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 please.
It's James Brown, recorded in 1956. He has a new memoir. It's called I Feel Good. Now, we've all heard your MC introduce you over the years. Why
Yes.
did you want an MC to introduce you in this fantastic way?
Well, because it's dramatic, it dramatizes a lot, and it's a build-up what show business should be about. Show business should really be a build-up and then... Once you go into it, you like live it. But it should be a great fanfare and a production. And that gets to the people, the chords, different kind of way you say it. The same as a minister would do in the church or a coach would do to his team. You have to have a way of getting started. And that's probably the best way that I know of, with a dramatic introduction.
Did you tell him what to say?
Yes.
And one of the things your MC has always done is, like, put on your cape, take off your cape. Why did you want to wear a cape?
The cape is because I saw a wrestler by the name of Gorgeous George. And Gorgeous George was a flamboyant wrestler who wore curls in his hair at that time, and he was really sharp and really different, a little early for most people. you expect him to win if he didn't win. So it was kind of a thing where he was a great wrestler, so it made great for his production. It made him quite, Gorgeous George reminded me a lot of Hulk Hogan.
The wrestler, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, have you always had your clothes made for you?
Most of the time I design them. I started wearing red suits years ago, and they thought we were crazy. But we wanted people to say, there he is, not where he is. And the same thing applied to the famous fans that were working with me. Right, Tommy?
That's right.
And I do the same thing with Tommy Rea right now. I make sure her clothes are designed different. A lot of times she don't agree with me, but that unique way and that individual look is very important. It's the same thing I have right now.
My guest is James Brown, and he has a new memoir called I Feel Good. Speaking of I Feel Good, I want to play I Got You, I Feel Good, one of your most famous songs. You have two versions of this. The first one you didn't release. You weren't happy with it. This was in 1964. What was wrong with the original version? What made you think it's not ready yet? It's not right yet?
You got to get it where it syncs with the people or where they're at. You know, I Feel Good was cut first with a jazz concept because I have a broad and a great more of ability to do more than one kind. Music, hear one kind of thing. There are so many directions that I go in, you know. So what I did, I went back about 4 o'clock in the morning. I called my band leader at that time. His name was Nat Jones. I recorded "I Feel Good" in Chicago, and it was too sharp, too slick. Had a baritone, you know, and the syncopation was so sharp. So I had to cut something. It was like, I feel good. Da 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 da. We call that staccato because it hits right on all the points. In the drum. So what we did, we want to get more of a funk feeling, a sanctified feeling. So we changed it and slowed it down. Wow, I feel good. Then that's two different kind of things. See? That's one is jazz because sharp mixes, and the other one kind of laid back, and gave you a little rock and roll feeling at that time as well. So we went with the laid back cut because that fit the street and fit the dances. A good thing I could dance because by being able to dance, I could really tell that the new arrangement, the new concept I had for it, really fell right in place.
What was the difference between the dancing you could do with the second version compared to the first?
Well, you could do the street dances. The first verse was, you might even do ballroom and everything with it, but the second verse was strictly for get down from the street.
Right.
And we need street action. That's what's basically wrong with the music today. A lot of it don't go street.
Okay, well, let's hear both of these versions back to back, the unreleased and the released versions of James Brown, I Got You, I Feel Good.
Well, you'll notice that the The unreleased has a baritone in it,
mm-hmm.
with a heavy sound. And the other one don't have the baritone, but you'll see the difference.
Let's hear it.
Oh, I feel good. I knew that I would not. I feel good. I knew that I would not. So good, so good. I got it. Sugar and spice. I feel nice. Sugar and spice. So nice, so nice. Since I got you. And I feel nice. Sugar and spice. I feel nice. Sugar and spice. You. So good, so good.
two versions of James Brown's I Got You, I Feel Good. He has a new memoir, which is also called I Feel Good. Mr. Brown, the way you start that record with your, if I do it, I'll sound ludicrous, but, you know, the ow at the very beginning. It's so great. Can you talk a little bit about how you started doing that?
Well, the screaming and stuff come, I must admit one thing about it. A lot of the screaming, it was during that time when Little Richard was real big and Roy Brown, people like that. The screaming kind of came down the line, but Little Richard is really responsible for more screaming than I am because he used to do that, whoo, all that stuff years ago, and he was more or less into it. He was sanctified, and I was holy, but I wasn't sanctified, you know. So we kind of just borrowed things from a lot of each other, but Little Richard was very instrumental in a lot of the screaming.
My guests are James Brown and his wife, Tommy Rae. Brown has a new memoir called I Feel Good. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Maslio! Come on now. Brother, what it was that night. Ah! Let him have it.
My guests are James Brown and his wife, Tommy Rae Brown. Brown has a new autobiography called I Feel Good. Well, shortly after you recorded I Got You, you recorded Papa's Got a Brand New Bag. And I want to quote something that you say in your new memoir, I Feel Good. You say, Papa's Got a Brand New Bag changed everything again for me and my music. I didn't need melody to make music. That was, to me, old-fashioned and out of step. I now realized I could compose and sing a song that used one chord or two at the most. How did you start reducing your songs to being more about rhythm than about melody?
What I did with that, I brought just a lot of my songs as melody, but like I Feel Good, that's melody, all that stuff. But rhythm, all the way through the song. Now I was even rock and roll stuff had melody, you know. But I went with more of a jazz concept gospel situation. I was talking to Tommy, and Tommy Rae, she have her rock and roll stuff has melody, but then all of a sudden after she married me, she started to get in the Holy Ghost, and she didn't know it. While she was going over and over, she sang with the Swanee Quintet. See, we, you know, coming from the black community, you have a lot of Holy Ghost, you know, and a lot of gospel. And Tommy Rae got over to me and started doing the Holy Ghost thing, so. The melody it don't really fit when you get in the music they got today.
Now, at about this time, your beat really starts shifting from the two and the four to the one and the three. Can you talk a little bit about that shift?
Started,
yeah, go ahead.
It started that with Papa's Bag.
Right.
From that point on, it was one and three. And even before I Feel Good, Papa's Bag has a one and three.
Mm-hmm. Can you maybe just clap for us the difference?
Well, one is laid back, and you know, it's like, dun, ding, dun, bum. The one has syncopation. That's the difference. And you count it off, you right on the one, bam, doom, bang, bang. And then the other one, you say one and a two, and you be on a two, see, but with two is the upbeat, and I'm on the downbeat. That's the difference.
How did you start doing that?
Well, because of the fact that I'm a musician and I sing gospel as well, and I know the difference. It's not how. It was easy to do. Why would be the best thing. Why gave me a different feeling.
And was it hard to convince the musicians that this would work, or did they get it right away?
No, I paid them. And they played with it, and they played what I wanted, and that was it, because they would have never agreed.
They would have never agreed to it?
They would have never agreed.
Why not?
Well, because it was in their head that Mozart, Schubert, Beethoven, Strauss, Bach, Chopin was correct. And they used to tell me that I was wrong. So they thought that was a law in music. There's no law in music. There's a freedom in music. That's the reason why Tommy Ray and them sing rock and roll, right, Tommy?
That's right.
You get tired of being bedded down to one thing. Mm-hmm. So you start singing what you feel.
Well, why don't we hear Papa's Got a Brand New Bag, which you recorded in 1965. It's James Brown, recorded in 1965. He's my guest, and he has a new memoir called I Feel Good, and we'll be talking more with his wife, Tommy Ray Brown, in a couple of minutes. Now, some of the musicians in your band became famous in their own right later on, Maceo Parker, Fred Wesley, Bootsy Collins. And, you know, I interviewed Bootsy Collins a few years ago, and one of the things he said, I mean, he loved playing in your band, but one of the things he said is that it was hard for him to be so disciplined. It was around 1970, the era when you were recording Sex Machine, and he said, you know, everyone was freaking out, but we were standing up there being the tightest band in the land, having to wear suits and patent leather shoes, and you couldn't jump out in the audience and freak out and act crazy, and that's what we wanted to do. Did you know that someone like, say, Bootsy Collins really wanted to, like, be wild and crazy, and you wanted this really tight, disciplined band?
Well, I taught them organization. They didn't have organization. And discipline is very important. You wouldn't take, you know, I want them where they could play at West Point as well as play in the street on the corner. I mean West Point, a Navy Academy place. I want them to be able to go anywhere. And see, when I went to play Papa's Bag and stuff like that, I could play for the president, then I go and play for the people in the street. That's what you call being totally accepted and being totally straight about what you felt.
Can you describe what your rehearsals were like in, say, the 1960s or early 70s?
Well, I'll tell you, my rehearsals has always been very intense. But, you know, for somebody who works with me and somebody who's not just my wife but also my employer and my artist, would you explain that, how you feel in rehearsal time?
Well, first of all, it's an honor to be in a rehearsal room with you. But when he walks into the rehearsal room, he commands performance. And because of the respect in the room for him, people command themselves to perform for him. And he knows every note. If you're off a note, I don't care if 25 musicians are playing, he will find the bad note and who played it at what time. He has got an ear that even the person that played the bad note doesn't even know they played it.
Wait, I'm going to stop you right there. When he hears it, excuse me for one second, but when he hears mm-hmm. the bad note, what does he do about it? I mean,
oh, he stops and he says, you did this, or whatever, you know, he'll do with his voice. He'll make the sound, you know, and you're supposed to go, and it'll be so, even just this little minute difference, but he will hear it and know it. And he sings it to them through his mouth and explains to them how to play it, because he's not educated as far as writing music. He created the music, so he doesn't look at a piece of at sheet music. It comes from God, you know, and so he explains it with his mouth, and it's very interesting to see. And everybody listens, and then we get it, you know, and then we start up and do it until it's right, and we don't leave until it's done.
Is it ever embarrassing to be singled out that way?
Well, you know, it puts you on the hot seat, and when you first start, yeah, you get embarrassed, and you might even be foolish and make a fool of yourself because you're trying to stick up for something that, what are you sticking up for? You got the Godfather soul telling you how it's done. And instead of being grateful and just listening and doing what you're told to do, sometimes we think we know more than we do, and, you know, we need to look at who's teaching us here and really be thankful for that. But
Thank you.
We
do. Excuse me for saying that. And then I can always go to the keyboard or to the guitar, to the bass, or to the drums. I can hum it out and whatever. But I can show you the note on five or six different instruments because I play most of those instruments well enough to describe what I'm about.
And play most of them better than they do.
Now, do you ever find musicians? I know you used to find musicians, didn't you?
Oh, yes. I'll do it now, but, you know, the musicians now, they have a lot more respect, and they're more intense on doing right. Wouldn't you say, Tommy?
Yeah, it's been 8 years now of learning, And every day still I learn more about how to respect and how to really be quiet and listen and learn the James Brown way. And it's a different way. It's unorthodox. It doesn't make sense. It's not scripted. It's, you can't write it down. It's not musical terms. I read music and it just doesn't happen that way. Fred Wesley, I think, said it best, that it's just, he doesn't know where it comes from. He says he doesn't know where it comes from, but it's just, it can't be written on paper. And Fred Wesley was right. It's just James Brown.
So, Mr. Brown, what are some of the things you find musicians for back in the day?
Oh, a lot of major things. I did a total program, like a West Point. They got to be clean, neat, the shirt got to be pressed, shoes got to be shine, the suit got to be pressed. They got to play correct. They can't be looking off when they should be watching me, because then they miss something. I find them, because I don't have time to disturb what I'm doing. I mean, we always can get through it, but by the same token, those people would rather not get fined, so they have a little bit more discipline. And that's in every situation. I'm sure the President of the United States has ways of making people account for themselves.
What's the biggest fine you ever gave?
I don't know. Maybe 500.
James Brown and Tommy Ray Brown will be back in the second half of the show. Brown's new autobiography is called I Feel Good. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Ow! Oh! Woo! Fresh Air!
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, featuring the AARP Crash Course in Estate Planning, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from TIAA Craft, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good, TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with James Brown and his wife, Tommy Ray Brown. Also, Maureen Carrigan reviews Adam Hochschild's book, Bury the Chains, about the 18th century abolitionist movement in England. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with James Brown and his wife, Tommy Ray Brown. She sings in the band. James Brown has a new autobiography called I Feel Good. Now, I want to change musical directions for a second. And through your career, you've recorded, you know, ballads as well as you know, funk. And in 1969, you made an album with a jazz band, the Louis Bellson Band, and it was mostly or completely ballads on here. And I thought we'd listen to one of those ballads, because it's a really different side of you. You know, we were talking before about how you kind of focused more on rhythm than melody in a lot of your songs, but here you are really focusing on the melody. Can you tell us why you wanted to record this album of jazz standards with a jazz band behind you?
Well, I really liked Oliver Nelson, because he made those horns shout.
And he did all the arrangements on the record.
Yeah, he did. I wanted his stuff, but my concept, which was so different. There's so many customers. I need a key to turn me on, which was very hard for me because it was Louis Bellson's song. who was a drummer, and his wife was Miss Pearl Bailey. It was different. It was also different for me to do It's a Man's World, because I did What Kind of Fool Am I, the Sammy Davis thing, and I knew I wanted to go there, so I'd heard those people do it, and I knew I would do it, so it was really quite an experience.
Well, actually, that's the track I wanted to play, What Kind of Fool Am I?
What kind of fool am I? Yes, I...
It's so interesting to hear you sing like this, so why don't we play it and I'll sit back and listen.
You know, you sound like you're getting ready to sing something then.
No, I wish.
Okay. Let's take a listen now.
Okay.
What kind of fool am I, who never fell in love? It seems that I'm the only one that I've been thinking of. Tell me, what kind of man is this? An empty shell, a lonely cell with an empty heart may dwell. What kind of lips are these that lied with every kiss, that whispered empty words of love, that left me alone like thee? Why can't I fall in love like any other man? And maybe, maybe then I'll know what kind of fool I am. Tell me, tell me, what kind of clown.
That's my guest, James Brown, recorded in 1969 with the Louis Belson Orchestra. And James Brown has a new memoir, which is called I Feel Good. And Tommy Ray Brown is also in the studio, and we'll talk about how they met and got married in a couple of minutes. Did you ever want to be like a romantic crooner?
Only when I sing sometimes soft to Tommy Ray, and she can't believe it because I have many voices that most of the young people don't know about today, and she just kind of blushed when I sang sweet songs to her. What about it? You say you like them?
You are such a romantic, and you know, you're some of the best stuff I've ever heard that I like is like Messing with the Blues, and when you were really singing those soft, melodic, I mean, heartfelt songs. I mean, those are the ones that really, really got me into James Brown to begin with.
Feeling low down, yeah. I act like a clown.
I love it.
What were some of the bands and who were some of the singers that influenced you when you were growing up?
Well, there was number one at that time, that was many, many years ago, Louis Jordan. Louis Jordan, L-O-U-I-S. J-O-R-D-A-N. He had Caledonia, and one of the songs that Tommy Ray loved so much about me. You remember that? Which
Why
one?
Why is your big head so hard?
And ain't nobody here with a chicken.
That's right. Ain't no, blah, 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 blah. It's a sin. Yeah, that's right.
Ain't nobody here with us chickens. And hobble, 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 hobble. It's a sin.
Now, I mentioned that the album of ballads was recorded a year after Say It Loud. Let me ask you about Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. You say in your book that a lot of, you think a lot of white people misinterpreted the meaning of the song.
I think they didn't understand it because I said I'm black and I'm proud. I thought they thought it was some kind of revolutionary something that would separate us, or something that would preach black power and come into violence. But what they didn't know, we was trying to let them know that we should be proud of who we are and not feel down and left out. And later on, some whites asked me to record it again because they thought it was getting a little hairy in the street. And they thought the blacks should be a little bit more proud of themselves and not go off and worry about what the Caucasians are doing, or Italian or German or whatever. They thought it was a great idea later on.
What inspired you to record it in the first place?
Well, I was in L.A., and during that time, some police shot four or five Muslims from the Islamic world, and it became a real mess there. So I went and recorded, said, "Loud and Black and Proud," and tried to send a message not only to the white, but to the black as well, that pride was important, and not power. The word power and pride was so misunderstood. And I thought that pride was more important. It didn't mean I'm black and I'm bad, but black and I'm proud.
Well, let's hear it. And this is James Brown, recorded in 1968.
Put your bad self. Say it loud.
I'm black and I'm proud.
Say it loud.
I'm black and I'm proud.
Look here. Some people say we got a lot of malice. Some say it's a lot of nerve. But I say we won't quit moving until we get what we deserve.
James Brown, and he has a new memoir, which is called I Feel Good. One other record I want to ask you about, and that's Sex Machine, recorded in 1970, one of your really big hits. And, you know, pop songs have always been about love and sex, but they never really used the word sex before in the lyrics, I think. What made you decide to actually use the word sex in Sex Machine?
Well, sex, I don't know, you're not far from it with the dancing and all that stuff. And the emulation that they do when they get on the floor, whether it's ballroom, two-stepping, the Funky Chicken, or James Brown, or all these different things. So, and that's what's in your mind if you go by a pool and see young ladies out there in the bathing suits, swimsuits, because the men don't draw them, the women do. I decided I would use that term because we was at this dance. I mean, the fellas, girl was at this dance, and she was just sitting there, and he's sitting there, nobody doing anything. It was kind of just almost like wallflowers. So the fellas jumped up and said, "Get up! I feel like being like a sex machine, and let's dance." So they started. That was the concept. And it's not vulgar or relating to somebody else's girl or man. It's a, I got mine, and don't worry about his. The way I like it, the way it is. I mean, meantime, Ray's fine. I got mine, don't worry about his, you know.
Was anybody worried, either your producers or disc jockeys, about playing a record with the word sex actually in it?
James Brown was the producer, so it wasn't no problem.
Okay. Here's Sex Machine, recorded in 1970.
Fellas, I'm ready to get up and do my thing.
Go ahead.
I want to get into it, man, you know.
Go ahead.
Like a sex machine, man.
Yeah.
Moving, doing it, you know.
Yeah.
Can I count it off?
Go ahead.
One, two, three, four. Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Stay on the scene.
Get on up.
Like a sex machine.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Stay on the scene. Machine.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Stay on the scene.
Get on up.
Like a sex machine.
Get on up.
Wait a minute. Shake your arm. Then use your palm. Stay on
a sex machine. You got to have the feeling. Sure as you're born. Get it together. Right on, right on. Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
That's James Brown. He has a new memoir called I Feel Good. How did you learn to dance and specifically to do splits?
Well, I guess I come from playing baseball.
Wait a minute. Most baseball players do not do splits.
Well, now they don't. But those years, Jackie Robinson, the first black man, came to Major League Baseball. And he was doing the split on first base. And they thought that was absurd. They couldn't believe it, but it was like a way of clowning. There was another black baseball team called the Indianapolis Clowns and the Kansas City Monarchs before black. There was the Negro Leagues. And eventually when Robinson got into Major League Baseball, he brought some of those traits with him. We miss so much because had those black men had been able to play baseball then, it would be like the coaches today. 90% of all the players are black.
My guests are James Brown and his wife, Tommy Ray. Brown has a new memoir called I Feel Good. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Ah! Hey! Tell me what you gonna do about that. Tell me what you gonna do. I got to know. Do you know how I feel? Tell me what you're gonna do. Yeah, about that. I got ants in my pants and I need to dance. Come on.
My guests are James Brown and his wife, Tommy Ray. Brown has a new autobiography called I Feel Good. So you first, I think, danced when you were a kid, and you danced on the street for pennies.
I danced to pay the rent for the soldiers. I mean, Tom Ray goes by there a lot now, and she liked to take little James by because she wanted him to see more or less. Explain what you're saying about why you go by.
Well, I like to show our son. I want him to know where his father came from. I don't want him to think that he was born into this James Brown succession and that he has a right to it, because he doesn't. He was just blessed to be born. So I want him to know his father and where he came from and the hardships that his father went through so that he could have the things that he has. So I make it a point to educate my son on what his father has done.
Tell us about some of those hardships, about what life was like when you were very young. James Brown, your mother left when you were four, I think, and you lived
yes,
with an aunt. What was the house like?
Well, it was very, very hard. I didn't have a place because my mother left, and my dad took me to see my grand aunt, great aunt, and he was his grand aunt. She raised me, and kind of babysitted me, but my daddy did. Basic menial work that didn't have any skill about it, but they had to go all over the country to find work, somewhat like they're doing now. Having to find a place that common labor can make it, you know. There's not a lot of room for common labor even in those days. That's when I tell the kids to get an education today, because we never know what's going to be up there for you, and if there'll be anything for you. So it was real, very hard. That's one reason why Tom Ray and I became man and wife, because she came up the hard way that way, and we related. I mean, you know, you don't take color to relate. It takes character and the contents of the character, like Dr. King said. And when people can know someone and don't even know the name because they're upbringing.
Tommy Ray, James Brown, you've been married now for how long?
Well, we've been married for 3 years mm-hmm. on December 14th.
How did you meet?
And we met, actually, I was doing the Janis Joplin show for Legends in Concert in Las Vegas. And I was doing her act, and I... one of her old his background singers that used to do background singing for him, Candace Hurst, I taught her how to write a song and play guitar about 20 years ago. And she said, I want to pay you back for it. And I said, what are you talking about? She said, you want to audition to sing for James Brown? I said, are you kidding? So I did. I went there, and I met him, and I said, hello. And I sang a cappella. I think I sang Mercedes-Benz for him or something. And he said, you're not a background singer. And at that point, I thought that I didn't get the job. But in fact, he hired me and my band to be the opening act for him. And me and my band traveled with him throughout Europe. And it became a problem traveling with two separate bands. So he then involved me into his group. And now I'm his lead soloist, and I also do the backgrounds for his music as well. So I, now it's just there. After we did that, you know, I was so impressed with watching him command the stage and the rehearsal room and the studios that I just started falling in love with this man and what he did. And the more I learned about what James Brown was and the things that most people don't know that he did for our country and for humanity. And it made me fall in love with this man. And we started dating, and then we had our son, and we decided at that point it was time to get married. So we did.
What would you say you learned about singing or music in general, about rhythm from working with James Brown?
Well, I learned I didn't know anything before, and I really know little now. And every day I'm learning more. And the minute that I think I know something is when I'm dead before I start, because there's always something new for me to learn. But I've learned to be a better singer. I have learned to take more control of my notes. I've learned to take more control of my lifestyle. I've learned that this business has a lot more knocks and bumps in the road than I ever thought it would, and that it's really, really a rough business. And had he not given me the opportunity, I can see now that I'm in it that I never had a chance. And I really, really believed in the dream that I could make it. And it's so hard for someone to make it.
Well, Tommy has really not just turned on music around, but she's turned her concept around to how to face music, and her stage presentation is just awesome. She is really, not because on the backside her name is Brown, but she's always be Tommy Ray to me, and I tell you that I just enjoy the fact that when a person can chastise himself, or would, she beats herself up, and I admire her for that because I do the same thing. Tommy?
And I just want to tell you, thank you so much. You know, we listen to NPR all of the time, and I definitely remember, I know your name, I know your voice, I've heard you on your shows, and I just want you to know that we listen to you all the time.
Oh, you got a couple of fans here.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And just one more thing, and I'll let you go. Mr. Brown, what's it like for you to have the same woman be both your wife and your lead singer?
Well, I tell you, it caused a lot of squabbles, you call it, but the house squabbles that leads into craziness sometimes. But we love each other very, very much, and I'm going to continue being the same kind of person, dominant when it comes to my music and my business. And I compromise as a husband, but not as a leader or manager.
I thank you both so much for talking with us.
God bless you.
Thanks.
We love you.
Have a wonderful new year.
You too. James Brown has a new autobiography called I Feel Good.
So good, so good, I got a year.
Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Adam Hochschild's new book about the abolitionist movement in England. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Adam Hochschild's award-winning book, King Leopold's Ghost, explored the history of European rule in the Congo and was praised by critics for being both scholarly and entertaining. His latest book, Bury the Chains, is also a narrative history, one that chronicles the struggle to end slavery throughout the British Empire. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
If Bury the Chains were nothing else but a narrative history of the 18th century citizens' movement to end slavery in the British Empire, it would be a terrific book. Author Adam Hochschild knows how to tell a story, and what he calls this ragged and untidy epic of the first grassroots human rights campaign is marked by cliffhangers, inspiring acts of lone defiance, bloody revolutions, saving twists of fate, and a cast of characters even Dickens might have deemed too over the top. But Hochschild aims for something even more ambitious and elusive than uncovering the story of this largely forgotten anti-slavery movement. He aims to trace the evolution of an emotion, the emotion of empathy among the late 18th and early 19th century British citizenry. As Hochschild says in his first chapter, there is always something mysterious about human empathy and when we feel it and when we don't. Slaves and other subjugated people have rebelled throughout history, but the campaign in England was something never seen before. It was the first time a large number of people became outraged and stayed outraged for many years over someone else's rights. And most startling of all, the rights of people of another color on another continent. Hochschild begins his account at a moment when this curious emotion of empathy for the empire's slaves makes its first public display. In 1787, 12 men, many of them religious dissenters, gathered at a London printing office for the purpose of discussing how to end slavery. As Hochschild vividly demonstrates, the group may as well have been strategizing how to turn the sky orange. The economy of the British Empire was absolutely dependent upon slavery, from the sugarcane plantations of the West Indies to the rope-making and shipbuilding industries based in England itself. So who were these oddballs who thought they could change the world, and how did some of them come together at that printing shop? As Hochschild describes them, the leaders of the British anti-slavery movement were as various and sometimes quirky as the sources of their life-altering leaps of empathy. Thomas Clarkson, whom Hochschild dubs one of the towering figures in the history of human rights, was a gangly 25-year-old divinity student at Cambridge in 1785 when he wrote a prize-winning Latin essay on the assigned topic, "Is it lawful to make slaves of others against their will?" Clarkson took the striking position that it was not, and evidently his argument was so persuasive that he himself was won over by it. For decades hence, he traveled England by foot and horseback, gathering damning testimony from, among others, disgruntled slave ship crew members about the evils of the trade. James Stephen was a dissolute ladies' man when he landed in Barbados in 1783 to make his fortune. The scales fell from his eyes when he witnessed a murder trial where two slaves were sentenced to death by being burned alive. John Newton, author of the hymn Amazing Grace, was a former slave ship captain who very late in life repented, long after he wrote the hymn, by the way. As these men and others like them began to agitate for an end to the slave trade, Hochschild says they invented many of the political tools that activists today still rely on: wall posters, lapel buttons, mass mailings, and boycotts. Naturally, one of the pitfalls for white middle-class readers of this saga that largely features the heroism of white middle-class abolitionists is that we'll end up feeling all warm and self-congratulatory about our kind. Hochschild stresses throughout that the work of these 18th-century white crusaders would have come to naught were it not for the courage of escaped slaves who testified about the barbarism of their situation in court, as well as for the tireless campaigning of singular figures like Olada Equiano, an ex-slave whose best-selling memoir, first published in 1789, ushered white readers into the fetid cargo holds of slave ships. Hochschild exhaustively explores all of these and scores of other events, bombarding readers with statistics, biographies of minor but pivotal characters, and economic and maritime background history, all without doing damage to the suspenseful pace of his main narrative. Hochschild does such a brilliant job of accustoming his readers to the inevitability of slavery that when the institution is finally abolished in the British Empire in 1838, it's hard at first to take in such a monumental shift in the order of things. Bury the Chains is a thrilling, substantive, and oftentimes raw work of narrative history. In its own fashion, it furthers the abolitionist's crucial work of lifting our moral blindness.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Bury the Chains by Adam Hochschild. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org, and from Delacorte Press, publisher of The Villa of Mysteries, a novel of suspense set in modern-day Rome by David Hewson, author of A Season for the Dead. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, John McRae of the band Cake. Also, we talk with Washington Post reporter Robert O'Hara Jr. His new book, No Place to Hide, is about the security industrial complex created after September 11th. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.